Went to the Buddha, how much to the Dharma, how much to the Sangha? Good morning again. So, what I wanted to talk about today is a topic that's been coming up a fair amount in Sanzen. People are bringing into interviews. And it's a topic that can be triggering for many. And so, please keep mindfulness active during the talk, right? If you need to look out the windows and enjoy some autumn scenery, do that. Or if you need to look around the room and notice that you're surrounded by people who care about you, like let that in, soak it up. There's plenty that is beautiful and worth appreciation, and it's skillful to stay in touch with that. I want to talk about fixed views. I want to talk about my sense of Dharma Rain as a temple within this broader ecosystem, the social sphere, and I want to talk about what the Buddha said about skillful activity in the political arena. So let's start by locating fear and finding a state of equanimity. Notice the periphery of your awareness. Right? How far out do you go? What can you feel with your skin, your fingers, your toes? There's no answer I'm looking for. It could be anything. You can make a little movement if that helps find a particular sensation. Take something that occurred, some sensation you found, and get closer. Zoom in on it. Where does that sensation begin and end? Can you stretch it? Might it have a texture, a color, a temperature? Holding your attention there. Does it change? Over that 20, 30 seconds, how has that sensation changed? And then open up that lens of awareness a bit and notice what it's like to be investigating in this way. There's possibly some confusion, probably some curiosity, hopefully a sense of satisfaction. It feels good to notice, especially if there's some measure of clarity, and especially if we're actively feeling willing to experience whatever it is. And then open up a little wider and notice the room. What it feels like to be here. So that's a way of touching some equanimity. If we look with direct experience, we find that it feels good to allow. It actually physically feels good to be open-handed about what it is we're experiencing, which is kind of different from conventional wisdom, right? We have long lists of preferred and unpreferred experiences, topics, opinions. And when we encounter something, we tend to implicitly consult our list and reaffirm our conditioned identity by having that recommended experience. If we're not watching with mindfulness, we tend to make a lot of decisions that way. And we've also all had this experience of staying soft and somehow broader than the situation, of being big and curious and connected enough that we don't actually need to protect, that we don't need to harden, we don't need to separate. I'd like to reach for that during this talk. Equanimity that I'm describing here is the exact opposite of the sensation we feel when we're insisting on something, right? When I insist, I feel small, I feel tight, my lips, my belly, my brow, my throat. I feel like there's some kind of external pressure that I have to resist it. And that have to is important. It doesn't look like a choice. Often there's a should, a have to, that's wrapped up in there for me. Maybe that's about my behavior, or maybe it's my evaluation of something. This should be different. There's often a strong sense of right and wrong, good and bad, which is interesting because so much of our identity gets leveraged there. It means that the slope to reactivity is pretty steep. And there's a very, in this, when I'm insisting, there's a very obvious sense of separation, right? Of distance, of difference. And it feels kind of critical for safety that I maintain it, right? There's also usually some kind of time pressure. Those are things that I notice. To me, it kind of feels like the precept of do not kill, right? When I'm breaking that, that's basically what it feels like. And all of that is quite unpleasant, right? So what I'm encouraging is be gentle with yourself. And if you find that mind creeping in, notice. And remember the possibility of curiosity, of equanimity. So far, so good. Okay. So I want to just take a look at Dharma Rain, like who we are as a temple in this field in relation to political activity. We have a lot of members who are politically active and aware, engaged. And we don't lead with this very often. So there's some tension there. Portland and Zen, at least Western Zen, for that matter, has a reputation for being pretty heavily weighted towards the liberal end of the spectrum. And there's also a wide variety of political opinion that shows up here. Some religious organizations are known for being pretty politically oriented. And that's woven into the practice and teachings. And that's not the overall tact that we have taken historically. We've tended to focus to kind of take on more focused issues that have pretty broad appeal. And we've tried to make this a safe and welcoming space, a refuge. And I think it's mostly received that way, but certainly not always. One of the guiding principles that Kyogen and Gyoko held as they were shaping Dharma Rain was that of inclusion. they trained in a very particular environment that had some pretty heavy lines drawn. And when they were kind of shaping this community, they were focused primarily on making the monastic lay and the youth practitioner differences more integrated, that there was not as big a dichotomy. So that's part of the DNA of this temple. Dharma Rain as a name is a metaphor for inclusion, for equity. It comes from the Lotus Sutra, the medicinal herb chapter. Part of this overall equation is that we're incorporated as a nonprofit. And so there's particular hoops we jump through. We're not allowed to endorse political candidates. We can't participate in or intervene in any campaign on behalf of any candidate. We are allowed to take positions on policy issues, as long as that message doesn't favor or oppose any particular candidate. And individual members and teachers have plenty of political opinions. Most of what we're associated with politically as a temple, I think, my sense, is prison work and also collaborations with various neighborhood, environmental, educational nonprofits. Right, some of that is accidental, some of that emerges, you know, right out of core values. Assuming there's interest and capacity at the temple, it's fairly simple for the temple to provide that kind of direct service in an area of need. Right? That's how these kinds of projects have emerged and endured. You know, Kyogen started writing someone on death row. Geshen started going into OSP, and 30 years later, we're in 7 or 8 institutions. It's more complicated advocating for policy, trying to influence opinions rather than providing a service. Dharma Rain has a mission, a vision, core values. Let me read 2 of those. This is on the website if you're interested, but it's relevant. Thorough commitment. Practice needs to be integrated throughout our lives. We operate the institution in an ethically sound, socially mature, environmentally sustainable, ecologically sensitive, and fiscally responsible manner. We strive to model the Dharma in how the organization operates and communicates. So there's a lot there. Another one, accessibility and inclusion. We strive to make the Dharma available via many pathways into a diverse spectrum of people, guided by the understanding of the importance of way-seeking mind. We've made an explicit commitment to equity and openness, and we attempt to minimize obstacles that people encounter in their search for the Dharma. So those are things that we return to in making decisions. As a temple. One of the internal policies, one of the ways we make decisions, is that, you know, when someone suggests that we endorse something, some cause, both the board and the Dharma Council have to agree on that. So those are 2 of our governing bodies. The board kind of does fiscal stuff. The Dharma Council does more teaching side. So if the temple is signing a letter, sponsoring a cause, something like that, there is a process for that. And it's a little unwieldy, right? Each of those bodies meets once a month-ish, more if it needs to, but hopefully once a month. You know, often something doesn't go through on the first try. There's questions or refinement or something. In the past few years, we've used that process to support the Community Resilience Hub legislation in Oregon, for instance. We try to use that process for something else, a clean air initiative in the metro area, but ended up not having enough of a consensus there. So it involves a bunch of people and a bunch of time. So it's kind of conservative. A lot of activist sanghas tend to be more vertical in terms of power structure, decision making. So one person can decide more easily. And that's not how we're set up. And I really appreciate and trust that. It takes a lot of energy and patience to exist in that kind of harmonious community. But it's a much more healthy, resilient, rich ecosystem. It would be easier, at least for me, if I could just decide things and it would be a much worse product, right? I'm really clear about that. I'm really invested in the communal, interdependent, emergent nature of this sangha. I'm not sure how obvious it is if you're brand new here, but there's a lot of cooks in the proverbial kitchen. It's a little wild and it's surprising, and there's a lot of well-differentiated wisdom here. And is being brought to bear on current events. So I'm trying to, with this talk, trying to make that process a little more visible because we collectively have questions about that. I'm very open to Dharmarain taking more of a stance. And I want that stance to be something that emerges from our temple's cultural process. So I want to turn to a few things that the Buddha said on this topic. He said a lot about personal conduct and ethics, of course, but he also spoke about how communities conduct themselves and how they are best governed. One thing he says is that rulers honor, respect, and venerate the truth. They have truth as their banner and guide. They provide just protection and security for their courts, troops, aristocrats, assistants, Brahmins and householders, townspeople and country people, ascetics and Brahmins, animals and birds. They do not let injustice prevail in the country. They provide support for the poor. That's from the Digha Nikaya number 26, the Wheel Turning Monarch Sutra or Sutta. This passage is advice being given to a prince who's in the process of becoming a world-turning monarch. This is in the far distant history. And the bulk of this sutra is the story of what happens when rulers don't care for the poor. At the beginning of the sutra, people lived for 80,000 years. And at that time, someone is brought into the ruler, caught for stealing, and the ruler says, "Why did you do it?" And the person says, "Like, I can't live otherwise." And so the ruler gives him some money and says, "Okay, do good with this. Like, take care of yourself, et cetera, et cetera. Use it in a wholesome way." And that happens a couple of times, and the ruler gets nervous and is afraid that he's getting taken advantage of, and so he decides, next person I'm going to cut off their head. And so he does that, and then that continues. And in the sutra, there's more misery, fear, distrust, and the next generation only lives for 40,000 years. And so this is the Pali Canon, so it's quite repetitive. And so we get it halves again and again and again until people are only living for 10 years. And then there's kind of this wake-up call. And at that point, the ruler and the populace decide, okay, we're going to get with a program. We're going to start refraining from harmful conduct. And lo and behold, lifespans start going back up. So there's an optimistic note. Nikaya means long discourses, so that's where all that repetition comes from. There's some key values shown here, right? Integrity, generosity, non-harming. I suspect all over the political spectrum, these are shared values, right? The vast majority of people feel like it's good to be generous. It's good to tell the truth. And not everyone prioritizes those the same way. Certainly, we don't hold the same views on how to carry those out in a community, state, or national level. And we probably each do some fancy gyrations to avoid the dissonance that comes with noticing how our behavior doesn't align with those values. And what the Buddha says in this sutra is that a good ruler should not harbor any form of hatred against any of their subjects. Should not harbor any form of hatred against any of their subjects. Again, integrity, but also equanimity, perhaps compassion, generosity, right? Hatred depends on fixed view and fear. If you don't have fear and fixed view in the mix, you don't have hatred. There, these and fixed view and fear, like these are lifetime projects, right? It's not an easy checkbox. But we can make a real difference, right? There is a pivot. It is possible to start reframing from harmful conduct. Something that's more often cited from the Pali Canon, but that came much later after Emperor Ashoka, is the Dasavatthira Rajadhamma, the 10 virtues of rulers. So let me just give you this list. Dana, which is generosity and caring. Sila, which is virtue or ethics. Padishaga, which is altruism or selflessness, not taking personal advantage. Ajava, honesty or integrity. Madhava, gentleness. Tapo, self-control. Akhoda, non-anger or calmness, kind of evenness. Ahimsa, non-violence or harmlessness. Kanti, which is patience or forbearance. And Aviroda, which is uprightness, non-obstruction, conformity with the principles of the Dharma. One of the commentaries on this one says that this means not going against the wish of the populace or doing anything that would harm the populace. I'll just notice for a moment. These are kind of like the precepts, in that when we're in a state of deep connectedness, of equanimity, these are obvious, right? It wouldn't make sense to do anything else. If non-duality is present, there's nothing to cut off. There's nothing to kill. I hope one thing that jumps out from this list is that we'd like this for ourselves. These are a relevant list of virtues for anybody and everyone. And if we have significant leverage, there's all the more responsibility to behave skillfully. I aspire to embody these, and I want the temple to aspire to embody these. If I have one takeaway from 30 years of watching karma, it's that it's so much easier abstaining than making a mess and having to clean it up. One of the things that shows up in Sanzen is like a frequent point of confusion is an either or around engaging, right? Like how we connect to our own sense of power, of agency. And also there's a lot of there's just a lot of anger. And I really work with this internally, right? Like I'm in this mess. I stay informed, I have emotional responses, and I actively, vigorously draw on the teachings and my practice frequently during the day to steer myself closer to, you know, something like this list of virtues, right? Personally, I'm very concerned about the expansive use of emergency powers, right? Of undermining the independence of Congress and the courts, of politicizing courts and agencies, of targeting certain media, businesses, now nonprofits, universities, of unconstitutional use of military force generally, and particularly the possibility of that here in Portland. I'm alarmed by what appears to be the active promotion of a Christian state and the erosion of norms of separation of church and state. And yeah, the grief for seeing the callousness that is shown to marginalized communities, especially Black and Brown communities all over the world and here, is quite close. That lump in the throat and the tears in the eyes have been quite close the last few months. So I'm willing to have this conversation in this community, right? I'm curious. I don't have any idea where it's going to go. I want to approach it with these 10 qualities as close as we are able. I hope that we stay grounded in the truth of non-separation, of non-harming. I want us to value and protect the sense of respect, safety, peace, harmony that we have here. It is valuable. It is needed. And I trust that we are mature enough Sangha that we can tolerate the differences that we find.
If you are in the sendo, please raise your hand and I will bring the microphone to you. Please speak your name before you offer your question or comment and hold the microphone close to you so people on Zoom can hear you. If you are on Zoom, please, you can type in your name or your question in the chat box and Tony will unmute you or read the question for you.
see you. This is Mikio. Yeah, this was pretty real for me past few days. Relatives are staying with us, mm-hmm. and one of them clearly have different view. And I really wanted to talk to the person, and I just realized that I don't know how, and also I haven't seen, like in the media, like of like examples mm. of how to approach people with very different political view, and having not particularly productive, but at least, you know, I'm hoping that we end up not like farther away from the person, but closer.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, I couldn't figure it out. So that's my comment here. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah, I think overall the environment is quite polarized, and there's a lot of belonging that is at stake for folks. And so it's very much a safety thing. And and like a conversation that connects across significant difference is subtle and slow, and it's hard to convey outside of that immediate context. It's not something that shows up on social media very well. So I think it's a real concern, and I think the tools that we're learning here about staying in touch with our like immediate experience and being able to stretch our heart, being able to look past the difference and see the commonality is really important in being able to do that with some skill and reliability.
On Zoom, there's a comment. It's from Holden. He says, periodically, I'm overcome with fear that people like myself being specifically targeted. How do you suggest I manage this fear when it feels so close?
Well, I feel like we could have a long conversation about that. I think two things I'll say just as kind of like a stopgap is, one, ground in the present. Fear is future, is looking to the future. And yes, like that's part of our overall situation. And what's right now? So make use of that. Two, I would say is notice the things you tell yourself that feed that fear, right? There's usually some underpinnings that if we can catch them, like we see that they're not that relevant or they're not that real, or that they're, you know, some younger version of us somehow that is insisting on that. And use your net. Look to see what you find there. Got Guy and then Lindsay, maybe?
Yeah, I was about to say that I'm observing some situation where it almost feels like being back in high school and you have a bully and you're told, don't take the bait. Don't antagonize the bully and give that bully, material fuel to do more bullying. But on the other hand, if you kind of shrink back and look away, then the bully just will escalate on their own. So yeah, you're on the horns of a dilemma, you know?
That's what I was going to say, is that there's two horns, and I encourage you not to get stuck by either. There's more options. There's always more options.
On Zoom, Oren wants to have a question or comment.
Thank you, Kakumio, for your talk. I've been long concerned about the way that this culture wants to break things into good and evil. It's like a little twig that fell off your top. And I'm particularly concerned how prevalent that is in children's literature and children's story. But I have to admit, I'm having a hard time not falling into that with the current situation as it is. I'm not sure you have anything to offer, but that's where I'm at.
Yeah, thanks, Oren. I think it's like as I said before, like right and wrong are so like we want to be good, right? Like that's part of how we recognize ourselves, and it's such a trap. And so it's this kind of dance with relative and transcendent that we do in Zen. Right and wrong are very much views. They're very much like conditioned opinions, and so I don't want to get fooled there. And like, I notice a difference between something that is wholesome and something that is harmful, right? And I don't want to like deny myself the ability to notice that in the interests of not getting caught by duality. So like this is subtle stuff.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Lindsay. Thank you for your talk. You know what, I just want to share briefly, like, so I'm Jewish and as well as Buddhist, but this year I've been really actually trying to kind of reconnect to my Jewish heritage, and I went to Yom Kippur services this Thursday, and it was really moving, and I just want to share briefly, there's these aliyahs we do, so like blessings, right, mm-hmm. to different groups, mm-hmm. and what happened was, like, it really moved me to tears, like, the first blessing was for our LGBTQ community, and everybody from the community came up, and there was just this acknowledgement of what a terrible time it is for them, and there was a blessing for them, and there was a blessing for everyone impacted by Israel and Palestine, and it was like, it was so touching, and it was just mm-hmm. done really beautifully, and I think we have our own versions of that here, we do, mm-hmm. and I've seen that, but this time is like so, I think we all feel it's so different, and particularly like, there's just the suffering is so close, as you said, and I'm finding myself, I left that service really moved, and also feeling yeah. like I'm wanting something, like yeah. something kind of like to name that this time is different, and I wonder about that. I don't know what that would look like, right?
I don't know either, but I'm like, that feels like a very tangible, very doable request idea. So yeah, I like it.
Think about it.
Hello, my name is Julia. I'm down at the ICE facility multiple times per week, and in particular last night I saw both protesters and counter protesters tear gassed and pepper balled out a block. And what I saw was protesters come together and protect each other. And I think Portland is pretty good at that. And I'm really proud of us for that. In the story that you gave of the ruler, they had some deference to the teachings and to religious leaders. And I don't see that in the situation that we're currently in. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if there are teachings of times where rulers had no regard for religious leaders. Are we in a position where we can learn from those types of teachings, or are we, and in addition to that, are we in a place where we might need to come up with something new as a Sangha? Because I think that we all have the capacity to support each other in a similar way that I saw last night.
Partly because, like, you know, like the Buddhist canon, you know, it tilts a particular way. And so the stories that are told are the ones in which the Buddha had an impact and it got to be useful. And we don't know about the others. Like maybe they didn't happen, but maybe they weren't told. I don't know. I don't know of any, is one answer. Or the answer to the sub question A. And the B part, I feel like personally I've been kind of poised for a while, like a year, and kind of waiting. And I don't know if we're at that time, but it sure feels like it's closer. I think there's probably a lot of different answers for that in the room.
Thank you.
This is Amy. The statement that you made about like abstaining versus making a mess and cleaning it up, it's like something that I have been like circling around for many years and not doing a good job of that. So I just wondered if you could say a little bit more about your like understanding of what that means.
Sure. Like, you know, when, like for myself, when I put forth, reactivity, I'm acting out of a hard kind of sense of separation. Like there's just so like there's the immediate event, and then there's like how I see myself and how the other person sees me and how the people I talk to. And like, there's just like, there's layers and layers and layers and layers. And it's just so much momentum so quickly. And I just have a lot of respect for that. And which is not to say that like, I mean, like, I make lots of mistakes, right? like I don't freeze very often and refuse to, like, that's not my mode. I do respect the amount of cleanup that there is when I am, when I do have a miss. It's a real thing, and it takes real time. Repair.
Thank you.
On Zoom, there's a comment from Wendy. She says, thank you for this talk. It makes sense to me to invite the elephant in the room to tea.
Great.
My name is Ed. I just found myself tearing up, and so I'll just start with saying I've witnessed a lot of violence in my lifetime, and I have PTSD, fortunately not as severe as it could be. I try my best to channel my anger and outrage into constructive action and compassion. And Kanzian is a refuge for me. But every morning, it seems like there is a new outrage. And, you know, whether it is, you know, I try to limit, I try to limit my exposure to media, but also to be informed, to have that balance. And when I see a young woman being sprayed in the face with gas, with pepper spray for no reason other than shouting at someone, and an 84-year-old couple being shoved to the ground and bloodied for no reason other than they exist, I find it harder and harder to not see the people doing this as evil. And I don't like using that word. And I try to remind myself that there is a spark of the divine or Buddha nature within even that person. But there's another part of me, when the anger comes up, that says that, that I have the thoughts of what I would like to do that are not compassionate, can be overwhelming.
Yeah.
And the way I try to think of it is, this person needs to be deactivated in whatever way they can be deactivated.
Yeah.
So, that they can no longer do harm.
Yeah.
And
let me help. So that's do not kill, right? Like, that's the precept you're bumping up against. And I'm not saying, when I say you're bumping up against precept, I'm not saying you're doing it wrong, right? I'm saying, like, yeah, like, this is the environment, right? So that's a particular sensation. It's in the mix. And part of that sensation is what's the fear there? Right? Like, that's part of the prerequisite. And you don't have to confront that directly. Like you can find your inner sense of stability, security, in a roundabout way, and then look at that again. Right. But if you're caught by something, chances are our verbal intellectual process is too fast. Like, you're gonna be able to run circles around your explanations, and that ends up in this kind of reinforcing system. And so you've had experiences of really knowing deep connection. Like, that's something that's profoundly true. Right? From that state, it doesn't look the same. And so when we're affecting others, we want to be as close to that state as possible, because that's where karma has it weighs the most. We've got one over here.
This is going. Imagery that's been really useful in my practice through my whole practice life is the imagery of the jewel net of Indra. And of late, recently, I've been kind of invoking that imagery in my meditation sometimes when I feel these feelings of disconnection and difference and separation. Mm-hmm. And what I do specifically when I do that is, I'm not going to name names here, but any bully in the world, big or small, I remind myself that they're also part of that net. Mm-hmm. And I just find that helpful, to notice that connection. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I get kind of stuck with, well, what's next after that? But it's a helpful place to be, to know that we're all on that net and we're all reflecting each other.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think like part of what you're pointing to with that metaphor is that, and actually I was saying I was going to throw in here last week when Funya talked about it, oh, that's a great thing to pull in, and I forgot about it. So thank you for bringing that forward. Sorry for the digression. Part of what is so useful with that metaphor is that like each jewel is reflecting all the others and impacting. So like the work we do to like ground, center, reconnect with ourselves is actually bringing benefit to others, right? It's really important that where we're coming from in this kind of charged environment.
Okay, there's a comment from Kate on Zoom. She says, the feeling of being helpless is barely tolerable when confronted with cruelty.
Yeah. Yeah, and I agree. I think, you know, part of that is like by design. And I think part of a skillful response there is really working to not fall into that trap. It's kind of like the two horns of the bull. Like I have sovereignty over my mind, right? Like I get fooled, certainly. Like my karma is bigger than I am. But like I have a certain amount of control over where I put my attention, and that's up to me, and I'm not helpless. And that's actually pretty powerful in terms of how we navigate. Hey guy, let's see you.
You know, I come from a pretty angry family. You know, there was a lot of it when I was a kid. And, you know, for a long time, I believed that anger was a useful motivator. But just in my adult life, especially over the last decade or so, I've just found that that's just simply, in my instance, in my case, just not the truth.
Mm-hmm.
The anger gives rise to a tainted form of action, invariably. And it's part of this, what you referred to, this tipping point. Now you got a mess to clean up.
Mm-hmm.
And the body has, you know, gone into the various physiological modes that it does. And that simply will not be cleaned up until it cleans itself up, right? It's going to take some time for all that to sort of reestablish something looking like equanimity.
Right.
You know, so it's sometimes there's some conflict, this feeling of like, okay, now a compassionate allowing action to come out of compassion rather than anger, it's a winner. You know, I have found that I am no more likely to do something, anything out of anger than I am out of compassion. I can be pretty darn complacent in anger.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and just spin wildly and create just this maelstrom of hate and do not a damn thing,
mm-hmm.
You know. So it's a very interesting business, this. And not taking the bait is a real good starting point.
It is. Yeah. It is. And I would say that, like, the maelstrom is itself like a little bait, right? Like we're choosing like a certain amount, even if we're not voicing it or displaying it or acting it out, like there's choice about attention. And there's ways in which we're like, there's fixed beliefs that are supporting that. And there's interpretations and perceptions that are like allowing that. And all of that's part of this infrastructure of like anger. And so like, you know, more awareness, more mindfulness is leading to dismantling that over time.
Yeah, good yeah. choice of words, infrastructure.
Yeah.
It's like Jigo said a number of times. You know,
I'm going to cut you off, and we have time for one more question.
Really quickly, no, I think it's like to pick up trash.